How and why did a renewable energy project that was approved at the state and federal regulatory levels get shut down by local Mainers in a public referendum, with a majority of those who opposed it being very pro-climate action but anti this specific project? The answers and the ramifications for how these types of clean energy initiatives get evaluated and processed going forward is the focus today in episode 3 of our 5-part series, 53 Miles of Maine.
I think some of these conversations really haven't been had with the full population in a way. And this project unveiled a lot of ideas about opinion on the direction of the energy future. And I think Mainers want to be able to steer that and not be told what will be happening.
But one thing I would have done differently is recognize earlier that this was a public battle, not just a regulatory battle.
Welcome to Animalia, where we cover all things conservation, climate justice, and sustainability. 13 years ago, in 2009, Facebook launched their newsfeed. Far and away, in my opinion at least, the most significant product that company has ever created. Facebook's newsfeed forever changed the dynamics of how we discover, consume, and share information. It brought in enormous profits that sharing photos and life updates with friends and family never could. It shifted us into an era of personalized information bubbles that completely dominate our society today. It served a critical role in turning our political elections into a 24/7 reality show that resulted in, well, literally a reality show president. And it was the dawn of the more polarized world of news and media that drives our public discourse today, where everyone is competing for clicks. As it relates to this story here in Maine, and so many others like it propping up all over the world, it was the catalyst of a shift away from policymaking happening behind closed regulatory doors and into the public forum. There are, of course, pros and cons to the shift and how things get done in the world of policy and regulation. In the era prior to this shift, well, there was a lot of opportunity for corruption. Lawmakers and big businesses could easily cooperate behind closed doors and move things forward without much public pushback until long after the decision took hold. Sometimes this was a benefit for positive initiatives having a clear, concise path to getting approved. Sometimes this was to our detriment, as negative initiatives could also do the same. In the era we find ourselves in now, where more and more often the same initiatives that had their fate decided only at the regulatory level are now seeing their fate decided in the court of public opinion, we have a new set of benefits and trade-offs. More than ever before, there is power in the people to stand up to bad ideas that only benefit a select few folks at the cost of everyone else. However, since we also find ourselves in a time where misinformation can run wild and the overwhelming majority of people only read headlines and react accordingly, those same people could be supporting or standing against something based on wrong or incomplete, or at the very least, biased information. It's a bit of a conundrum we find ourselves in. The same technology shifts changing how we consume and interact with each other are making it easier for more polarizing, toxic people to get into power, and they're also making it harder and harder to ground people in the core truth around the key issues that they have increasing influence over. In a way, we have this duality where it is hard to both trust those in office and to trust information from a family member or neighbor, something you find in your newsfeed. Now, we're not going to solve that larger issue here in episode 3, but we are going to highlight how this shift played out on the story in Maine and what it means for other such initiatives going forward, and why I firmly believe that our urgent need to transition off of fossil fuels will depend more on what happens at the local level than what happens at the federal level, or what happens with technology or private capital. The fate of a majority of renewable energy projects will get decided by local communities, and that was the case here in Maine. If you haven't had a chance yet to listen to episodes 1 and 2, they're linked in the show notes. Now, episode 1 is a bit of a prerequisite to this one, as it lays out the timeline for what happened in Maine and how this project meant to bring hydropower and energy from a big provider in Canada into the New England grid via a purchase agreement with the state of Massachusetts, while got shut down by a Maine voter referendum in November of last year, long after it had received approval from state and federal regulatory agencies, primarily due to the environmental impacts of a key transmission corridor required to cut through Maine, as well as questions to the net climate benefits of the project overall on a global level. In episode 2, we unpacked the first of 3 larger themes we're using the story in Maine to provide a lens into. That theme being how and why there is more and more conflict brewing between environmental activists and clean energy advocates. Here in episode 3, we dive into the second of those 3 themes, how this project was stalled by a voter referendum after getting approval from state and federal regulators, and what this means for other large-scale renewable energy projects going forward across the United States. We're going to discuss the difference of opinion on the net benefits to Mainers, how the backers of this project originally approached local buy-in, and why their approach ultimately failed short. and we'll explore the contentious relationship often found between utility companies and their customers, and why there's a big effort right now in Maine towards a consumer-owned nonprofit utility structure versus the current one that was a key driver in the lack of trust in this project. Okay, now that it's all teed up, let's get into episode 3. To set the table for today's episode, it's important to first remind you that the key challenge ahead in getting off fossil fuels is less about how we generate it and more about how we move and store it. There is definitely more work to be done on improving the cleanliness for generation, as we learned in episode 2 in discussing the environmental trade-offs of hydropower. However, nearly all forms of renewable energy generation are cleaner than fossil fuel generation, and we have the generation capacity to fully get off fossil fuels today. The larger challenge lies in infrastructure and storage. Sources like wind and solar are intermittent, so they rely on massive battery systems to store peak capacity and use that storage in low capacity intervals. And all renewable sources outside of nuclear are typically generated far away from where they are needed the most in high dense urban areas. So we need a lot more infrastructure, transmission infrastructure specifically, to move that renewably generated power to where it's needed most. However, making batteries and building transmission infrastructure involves local environmental trade-offs in the form of mining for the minerals needed for batteries and clearing land needed for transmission. This is why so much of the work ahead will be at the local level, not the national one. Here's Anthony Maffa, an environmental lawyer at the University of Maine who supported this project.
The infrastructure and grid-related issues part of this equation are much less politically toxic than the generation. And by generation, I mean, where does the power come from? Not how is it transported from where it's generated side of this policy issue. Is the transmission line piece of it is much less politically toxic. That's not to say that one is more important than the other, but you could see why during a Republican administration over the past, 2016 to 2020, why the shift in focus away from, renewable energy generation to let's just focus on the win we might be able to get, right? Which is let's improve the grid. Because both things needed to happen.
It's interesting you say that, because from my observations, I would say the generation of energy, as you laid out, is more politically charged at the national level, at the congressional level. But from what I've seen, the infrastructure part is where a lot of the local level kind of political charge is happening, not so much about the generation.
That's a good distinction, because I think you're right. And I was speaking, kind of from my, with my EPA hat on and that experience, because it's where the generation, where that conversation kind of started. And I think as like a citizen of Maine, thinking about the corridor, you can see how the local politics kind of flip that equation quite a bit right now. I mean, especially looking at New England and solar, for instance, which gets support from both sides of the aisle for a variety of reasons. And then you have these transmission line projects that get opposition from both sides of the aisle for a variety of reasons and become very politically toxic. So I do think when you get as the scale of politics you're talking about changes, so too does what becomes more toxic. And I think you're totally right that transmission lines become quite toxic as you move, state, county, municipality. Once you're like down with the talking to the neighbors where the line is going to go through, it gets quite politically charged.
The fact that these infrastructure projects get politically charged at the local level is not a bad thing. In many ways, that is exactly how a democracy is meant to work. There's a reason our Constitution grants rights to states to govern their constituents at the local level. What becomes challenging is when democracy is trying to function within such a polarized information bubble like we're in today, which fosters distrust of institutional systems. Now, we can complain about this all we want, but it's not going to change or fix anything. The reality is we're in a new world order where getting public support is a necessary part of pushing these projects forward. A recent study came out just as we were editing this episode, which highlights 53 different solar, wind, and geothermal projects across 28 states in the U.S. that have been delayed or blocked by local opposition to either the generation itself or transmission infrastructure needed to move them forward. So even if you're in the camp where you don't support hydropower, which we discussed the merits of in episode 2, this local versus regulatory challenge is playing out across all renewable projects. Now, we're highlighting this issue not because there is no merit in local opposition Quite the contrary. In many cases pointed out in the study, and we'll link to it in the show notes, local opposition has flagged legitimate reasons to push back on some of these projects, with the number one reason being local environmental impact in 60% of those cases. However, for every legitimate case for pushback, there seems to be some cases where misinformation or simply conflicting priorities are also at the core. Now, with what happened in Maine, again, we are not staking any claim on our end on whether this project should move forward or not. The courts in Maine will now decide. The larger issue we are highlighting here is the need to recognize how these processes are shifting away from purely regulatory ones and towards a hybrid of a regulatory plus public review structure. So how did this play out exactly in Maine? If you recall from episode one, construction on the new transmission corridor in northern Maine from New England Clean Energy Connect started years before state and federal agencies officially permitted the project. Now, we heard that from Thorne Dickinson, the leader of the NECEC and the project architect. And he and his team began buying up land in anticipation of ultimately finding a deal to bring more renewable energy into the New England grid. By the time the public voted this project down in the referendum in November of last year, well over 60% of this contentious new corridor was already cut away and cleared. For many Mainers, the mere fact that they did not hear about this project until construction was long underway made them go into it very understandably skeptical. If someone was building a transmission line through your town or community and you find out about it in this way, well, it would probably frustrate you too. Now, that doesn't mean the NECEC was up to no good. They followed the process that has long been established for these types of projects through the state and federal regulatory agencies. The Maine Department of Energy, the Maine Department of Environmental Protection, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers all reviewed and approved this as a net positive clean energy project. Sticking to that traditional process versus asking for broader public support much earlier on does not mean there is something to hide or any malice. But of course, if someone feels a process is not as transparent as they would like it to be, regardless of what's right or wrong, but from their perspective, and the output of that process directly impacts them or their community, it's going to raise doubts. That's just basic human psychology. One such area this came into play, and the first topic we'll talk about here, was how the NECEC went about getting buy-in from the towns and communities through which the new part of the corridor in the northern part of the state would be built. Now, these are people who deeply value their local forest, outdoor recreation, and the culture long built up around Maine's contiguous forest system. If you tell someone in such a town that you would like to build a transmission line through their county in order to help support our needed transition to renewable energy, which of course is probably most critical for protecting these forests long-term and slowing down global warming, well, they are probably naturally going to ask, hey, are there any alternatives out there to accomplish a similar goal without the need to cut that transmission line through my backyard? Well, nothing about that request would be unreasonable. However, if you don't give them a full answer on what those alternatives were and why this particular project is a net benefit comparatively, and you don't even give them much of a chance to ask in the first place, you're going to get pushback. So how did the NECEC go about getting that local buy-in, and was it sufficient? From Thorne's point of view and others who support this project, the answer is yes, it was. For those who oppose it, the answer is definitely no, not even close. These divergent views on local support were very much core to many who opposed it. Now, here's Thorne.
And actually, we went around to had conversations just about every town. I think there were a couple of towns that for one reason or another, we didn't get to out of the 36 towns that we were going through. But we had great conversations. In the end, almost every town wrote a letter of support to the project. Now, when we eventually, in February of 2018, won, I've gone up between that window. I probably had maybe 50 trips up to that region. We went down the Kennebec River, talked to the rafters, talked to the hunters, talked about how we could make this project better, how we could work with the snowmobilers to make these available for use, the ATV users, hiker pass, hunting, all those kind of things. So there was a lot of dialogue all through this period. And also in the regulatory proceedings, there's a huge amount of public opportunity for comment. Some of those people I think you talked to participated in those regulatory proceedings through groups and coalitions that they put together. But also there was public comment. There were maybe five or six different times where people could, on the record, provide their perspective for and against the project. So there's a lot of competition now for people's attention and friends, both in support of the project and against the project. And I would never challenge anybody's perspective, but I know we were out there, we were talking to people, we were communicating, and we had regulatory process that were going on.
As you heard from Thorne, the NECEC went and got buy-in from representatives in each town. Of course, it would not be fair to expect or ask the NECEC to knock on every single door and open up a dialogue. However, it's also very possible that the representatives in some of these towns that Thorne is referencing did not always do their job, respectively, in widely getting that buy-in from their local community. That aspect of this project is not documented or subject to review necessarily. We trust our town reps to do the right thing by the community, but they don't always do it. Now, it's not the NECEC's fault if any of those town representatives didn't thoroughly do their job, but given so many of these towns ended up rescinding their support on the project later on, it does raise questions about the diligence of the process of getting local support up front. Here's Nick Bennett from the Natural Resources Council of Maine, who, as a reminder, adamantly opposes this project from the beginning through today.
Not all of it is brand new cutting, but a lot of it is significant clearing in parts of the state that, you know, while there are existing power lines, they're still really beautiful parts of the state. And people live right near where this cutting would happen and oppose it. And that's why you've had 26 towns along the corridor. Maybe it's not 26, maybe it's 20. But you had a whole bunch of towns along the corridor voice opposition to it. Those are not towns in the 53 miles. That's where we believe the greatest ecological damage would be, but there was still a lot of opposition to the rest of the corridor.
It was 25 towns in total that came out in opposition of the line. Several of them had originally supported it and then rescinded. I asked Thorne a bit more about these town representatives and how and why things change in terms of their support.
When you say you got the kind of letters of approval from majority of the towns early on, who within those towns was sort of giving that stamp of approval? And did you have any way to know if they were sort of kind of sharing it more widely? Or is that just like, there's no way to really know that? You're counting on the representative to do that job to its fruition?
We're really counting on the representative. I think in the most cases, they didn't have large town meetings. I think the people in the town that were responsible for and were elected to manage it looked at this project and said, well, this provides property taxes, and particularly for the towns that were along the existing corridor. So you're going to expand the corridor by 75 feet, put in a new line. We're going to get property taxes and jobs. All these other benefits seems to make a lot of sense. So that was the beginning general conversation. What changed in tone was somewhere right after we won. And that's when Calpine, NextEra, and our other friends kind of showed up on the scene. They intervened in all the regulatory proceedings late, but they were allowed in. And I sensed within a month or two, a major change in the environment. There was now these two factions. Instead of being about a project that helps the thing, it became a project from CMP, company you don't trust, and a bunch of Spaniards and a bunch of Canadians bringing power to Massachusetts. And the hostility, just like I see other examples throughout our culture, you pick a side and then you battle. And instead of actually trying to find common ground and look at the actual facts that were playing out in the regulatory process, that's when I sensed things started escalating. And then over a period of time, them working with particularly the Natural Resources Council in Maine and their advocacy within the towns, they more and more pressure was putting on those elected people. Most of them withdrew their support or actually came out against the project.
Now, there's a lot to unpack in Thorne's statement. From the outline of benefits for Mainers to the reputation of Central Maine Power to the involvement of three big energy companies who funded opposition marketing. The last topic we're going to cover in much more detail in the next episode, but these first couple we'll absolutely cover here today. Now, here's Sandra Howard, who again organized one of the largest grassroots campaigns to oppose the project.
So when they proposed the project in 2017, they were talking to select boards of two or three people per town. That would have been the time that they should introduce their project to the townspeople. So when I found out about it, a majority of the towns had sent a letter of support, but there were no permits that had been approved. There was no construction being done at that time. So we had to play catch up very quickly. When I found out about it in July 2018. That was right about when the DEP was soliciting for interveners for their permitting process. So we were able to get a group in at the last, you know, at the last moment under that deadline. But we, you know, we've been vocal against it prior to their construction. So, you know, the fact that they're not currently doing this, of course, the fact that they clear-cutted a majority of the 53 and a half miles, knowing that the referendum was coming, knowing that there are multiple agency appeals, court litigation going on, is certainly their own risk to do that. I think what turned off a lot of the locals along the line initially, and of course, you know, there's this idea of, is this a NIMBY issue? And if it was just people along the line who opposed it, it would be very different. But we saw, as you know, 60-40 on the votes statewide, and people from all across the state had problems with it. I think people if they had an opportunity to weigh in at that initial introduction with the select boards. So towns could take that vote or point out problems like, you know, this is going through a region that, you know, have you thought about going through Route 201, which is a scenic byway, and putting it underground or using railroads, you know, other ways to get it through. They would have had an opportunity to change things before it went through the DEP review process. And, you know, when Thorne have an opportunity to talk, he'll talk about that they made the project better because they listened to Mainers. And some of those things were mandated by the DEP. You know, we had a big problem with it going over the Kennebec River at a very pristine area where there's no infrastructure, and they decided to go underground with that, which also has other environmental problems. So I guess the answer to your question is, if Mainers had an opportunity to be involved at the earlier stages before this feeling of quiet support was being commandeered by, you know, two or three elected officials in each town, I think they would have had the opportunity to react to that and maybe garner more support.
So what are the benefits for Mainers specifically that were likely being discussed in those local meetings? Here's Lynn from Hydro-Québec outlining the two primary pillars of benefits from those behind the project.
Families potentially have, well, not potentially, have electricity bills where something is exercising downward pressure on those wholesale market prices, which is would be extremely helpful, would have been helpful in January and February in the case of the very cold winter that the folks in New England have known, and would likely be helpful in the months to come with the, our new geopolitical context. It's also a project that can make one huge, significant leap towards meeting decarbonization objectives.
Now, in episodes 1 and 2, we discussed why opposition groups like the NRCM do not believe this project has any net climate benefits at a global level. We're going to pause and put a pin in that for this episode, and we're going to come back to that much more in episode 4. Now, even if that's the case, let's take the assumption that Lynn is correct there. It's not fair to ask every local Mainer to equally care about the global climate benefits of this project and to have those trump their individual and local needs, especially when there are many different ways to get off fossil fuels. To be fair to the NECEC and Hydro-Québec, they didn't ask this of Mainers either, which is why there are two pillars of benefits here, the second of which being the net economic benefits for Mainers specifically. So what are those? Well, Thorne Dickinson outlined them in episode 1. Here's a list. Between $14 and $44 million in total rate reductions for energy bills for Mainers, $200 million in improvements to Maine's electricity grid, $18 million per year in local tax benefits for the communities along the corridor, 1,600 additional jobs during the construction period of the corridor, and over $500 million in net increase to the state GDP. Now, many of those who support this project felt that last point on the GDP increase was often left out or glossed over by opposition talking points and marketing. Here's Bed Dudley, a project supporter.
The other side, I think, was frankly less than forthcoming with the facts. What they did was they assumed that the economic positive economic impact for Maine was based solely on the $250 million in the settlement agreement. And that's the number that they roll out. You know, Mainers would get X dollars or X cents a month off their electricity bill. They based that strictly on the settlement agreement, totally ignoring the GDP impact of $1 billion investment in public infrastructure in the state of Maine. They just pretended that impact didn't exist. And that's just not honest.
Now, that said, there was some marketing going on from both sides here. One of the criticisms from those who opposed the project was that an overwhelming majority of those additional jobs were temporary. But the way it was marketed didn't necessarily highlight that at the forefront. The smaller permanent job creation number was not talked about as often enough. The smaller permanent job creation number was not mentioned as often. And when you compare to jobs that could be lost from other industries, well, the net job gains may not be there at all.
So if we think about how many jobs would be lost in just the biomass industry, that would wipe out any full-time job gain. So we're talking about temporary jobs. Their numbers changed. NECEC advertised 1,600, 1,700, 3,500. There was an analysis done I read through the PUC that said it would be 38 permanent jobs at the end. So, you know, this gets into that idea of, you know, where do we want our jobs to be in Maine? You know, the existing generators, and some of them are fossil fuel. So I know it gets complicated when we think about biomass and some fossil fuel, but these would be the net, it would be a net job loss in Maine if this had gone through. And then you factor in recreational tourism jobs too.
Both sides here focus their public messaging on the talking points and details that best supported their position. That is to be expected, but it does make it all that more difficult for everyday Mainers to make a fully informed informed decision on where they stand, given they too often are not getting the full and complete picture from any source of messaging and evaluating for themselves the benefits versus costs as it relates to their day-to-day lives. Another point of contention around how this project was approved was differing viewpoints over how much information was provided to the public and whether or not the public was given the proper time to review and assess for themselves. For example, on one hand, the Maine Department of Environmental Protection publicly released their analysis and assessment and justification for supporting the project. We link to it in the show notes. However, the review from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was often done behind closed doors. And more importantly, opposition groups feel that they did not have the access or the time or the opportunity to have their customary 30-day review of that assessment before it was finalized.
Of course, we would do better with more information, objective information. But the reality is that our regulatory agencies, our decision makers, are all subject to pressure of various kinds. A lot of it is pressure from very powerful corporations, and it's the job of groups like NRCM to push back on that.
Now, Nick is correct. Our regulatory agencies are absolutely subject to pressure and have given us many reasons in the past to be skeptical. Now, these are the same agencies that for many decades stood behind fossil fuels and the lobbying pressure applied to them. So it can be difficult to let go of these historical mistakes, even if there are regime changes. Think of people in your life, individuals that have burned you in the past. Now, even if they later show a strong track record of being trustworthy and reliable, given what did happen in the past, you're still going to be a tad bit more skeptical with those people versus those who never burned you at all. The same dynamic plays out with our trust in institutions. And to be fair to those who oppose this project, there were errors made by the regulatory agencies as well. A big one was the original permit for the corridor to cross public lands getting granted without the required two-thirds vote from the state legislature. This particular permit was deemed unlawful in August of 2021 by a superior court in Maine, and the NECEC worked to find alternative solutions. You heard this from Adam Cote, a lawyer for some of the opposition groups, back in episode one, but it's relevant to bring back here as well in part of this discussion.
When they talk about validly seeking permits and doing everything correctly, they're completely ignoring the fact that they've had a judge that completely threw out one of their critical permits crossing Maine public lands. Let me quickly address that. In Maine, we have a constitutional provision in the Maine Constitution that if you are going to reduce or substantially alter public lands, lands owned by the state of Maine, you need to seek approval from the Maine legislature to do that. And the reason we passed that and we made that part of our constitution is because for years, paper companies owned a bunch of land in Maine. Then the state took it over and the state was sort of willy-nilly getting this out to, you know, selling it to folks. We were having environmental issues. This was years ago. So a referendum passed in the mid-90s in Maine that said, we are going to make our legislature sort of the stewards of public lands. And for years since then, whenever there's a big project that's going to put a parking lot on public lands, have a transmission line on public lands, put an airstrip on public lands, it goes to the Maine legislature, they vote for it. I'm not aware of a single one that was ever rejected because generally they've been, you know, good projects. In fact, several transmission lines in Maine have crossed public lands and our legislature supported it. What did CMP try to do in this situation? CMP tried to structure the CMP corridor as a quote unquote lease instead of an easement over the land. They argued, well, if we do it as a lease, we don't need the legislature to even vote on this. And they really got caught with their hands in the cookie jar on that one because the legislature was furious that they were not going to them the way every other project that goes over public lands does it. It led to a lawsuit. They lost the initial round of the lawsuit, and the judge essentially pointed out all this sort of behind-the-scenes thing that CMP had done to go around it.
A reminder that when Adam mentioned CMP, or Central Maine Power, he's talking about the utility company that is majority-owned by the same parent organization as the NECEC. And we're going to get to CMP's role in this in just a second, is significant. The frustration for Lynn from Hydro-Quebec was that it felt like a big leap to make a claim that all of these regulatory agencies, because again, there were multiple groups that approved this project, were somehow in cooperation to pull a fast one on Mainers.
It's a little surprising to me that folks would claim that all of these agencies, from the Maine state agencies to the federal agencies, everyone's in cahoots and everyone approved this without it being a solid project. All of them are wrong to make this one group right.
Well, I think you and I both agree on something in that historically, all of those agencies have been in cahoots with the fossil fuel industry that has put us in this problem in the first place, right? I mean, let's be real. Like, the fossil fuel industry has used their relationship with government agencies historically. I'm not saying it's like this in this case, but historically has used their relationship with government agencies to push their agenda forward, to keep burning fossil fuels, to keep avoiding the costs, the societal environmental costs that come with them. That is one of the main reasons we're in such a climate crisis.
Right. I get that point. But I think that sort of casts aside the advancements that we've made in terms of understanding just the climate change, the notion of protecting the environment, notions of social acceptability. I think we've significantly advanced, thankfully, as a society, perhaps not enough to be able to address climate change in an expedient matter. But I think that in terms of regulatory review and understanding of projects that are needed to certainly address climate change, and in this case, it's not only the matter of climate change, it's also the matter of grid resiliency and energy security that are important, but I think that review processes have evolved to take into account those considerations.
Clearly, the trust in that process was not strong enough for local Mainers when they voted 60-40 in favor of stopping this project in November of last year. It now awaits its final fate in the court system. But this is a strong signal for all renewable mining and infrastructure projects out there that simply relying on the regulatory system in place and asking local communities to do the same places your project in serious risk of getting public pushback. Which brings us to the third and final topic of this episode, Central Maine Power, CMP. Their involvement alone was the primary reason for many Mainers to distrust this project. Now, CMP is one of two dominant utilities in Maine. They are majority owned by the same parent company of the NECEC, which is a big energy conglomerate out of Spain. CMP would be the utility company distributing this power from Canada to the New England grid. Now, utility companies don't exactly have stellar reputations to begin with. For one, they operate as pseudo-monopolies, given that in most cases, one only has a single choice for who to get electricity from. I know that's been the case for me everywhere I've lived. They have notoriously bad customer service. I myself have probably spent over 100 hours of my life on hold or on mind-numbing calls with my local utility company every time there's an issue with my power or my bill. Well, then there's the problem with their underlying business model. You see, most utilities make money as a fixed percentage of revenue, as well as on capital expenditures. For this reason, they have no real financial motivation to drive down costs and increase efficiencies. They have no strong incentive to be selective when spending on new projects. They're incentivized to spend money and raise rates. So utility companies and their customers often have a difficult relationship, even when things are going relatively smoothly. And with CMP in recent years, it has been anything but. Back in 2017, CMP launched a new billing system that wound up overcharging Mainers to the tune of $5 million. There is nothing more frustrating than getting overcharged by your power company with no pathway for immediate resolution. In 2020, state regulators, namely the Public Utilities Commission, finished their investigation and mandated a profit reduction for CMP to the tune of roughly $10 million. However, around the same exact time, that same commission approved a rate hike for CMP that yielded an additional $17 million in revenue. CMP's reputation at this point went from bad to worse. From 2018 to 2021, J.D. Power ranked CMP dead last in the entire country in customer satisfaction. Now, it wasn't too long ago that CMP was first on this very same list back in 2013. It's been a combination of these billing issues and how CMP handled their resolutions, along with their negative association with rooftop solar initiatives in Maine, which we'll discuss in a second, that really torpedoed their reputation. And with that, damaged the New England Clean Energy Connect as well.
It's far and away the most important point that in this time that we talk, James, that I could get out to folks. I've heard all sorts of speculation that the rejection of the CMP NECEC corridor was because of NIMBYism or Mainers don't understand the infrastructure changes we need during renewable energy and all of this transition that's taking place. I can tell you, having worked in clean energy my entire adult career, that had nothing to do with the rejection of this corridor. Central Maine Power Company, their parent company is Iberdrola. Iberdrola's U.S. sort of company, umbrella company, is Avangrid. Okay, so knowing those three companies involved, let me point out, Central Maine Power Company has been rated last by J.D. Power and Associates in the entire country for utilities. In other words, considered the worst utility in the United States, which is saying something when you consider PG&E was blamed for burning down half of California. You're out in California, so I use that as an example, right? Hey, they are more unpopular and they are considered a worse utility than any other utility in the state. Why? Because we have had massive billing problems. People will have consistently over the past several years gotten incredibly terrible bills from CMP, you know, thousands of dollars. You would get a bill for thousands of dollars. Then you would call CMP, you would try to find an answer of why this happened. You would get shuffled around. You couldn't talk to an actual person. Massive billing problems. We passed a renewable energy bill, a solar bill. I was on the working group that helped write this bill a couple of years ago. It was a landmark solar bill in the state of Maine to promote locally generated renewable energy in the state of Maine. CMP has been the biggest roadblock. Number one, they were the biggest roadblock in trying to get the bill passed. We've been trying to pass a renewable energy bill for years. CMP had multiple lobbyists in Augusta trying to defeat it. Number two, when it finally did pass, CMP had multiple problems with our solar developers in Maine trying to develop projects by not setting them up on interconnections. Interconnections meaning when you build the project, you contact the utility and say, hey, let's now connect to the grid. CMP would wildly change their estimates, saying, okay, it'll cost $100,000 to connect you to the grid. Then you build your project and you ask and you call them back, and all of a sudden it costs $1.5 million. That's just an example, but it's actually one that really happened. So there was an outpouring of problems with Central Maine Power Company, and there has been for several years. I will tell you another example. This company has been enormously tone deaf to these problems. When Iberdrola a couple of years ago had one of their executives come to Maine and talk about the NECEC project, he was the chief operating officer, I believe. And he came and he spoke to a bunch of Mainers about the NECEC project. And one of the Mainers raised their hand and said, how can you tell Mainers that we ought to trust you to run this project when you've had all these billing problems, you've had management issues, we lead the country in blackouts, you know, you've had interconnection, probably kind of went through the list, right? And the response from the Iberdrola executive essentially said, Mainers need to, you know, put that behind them. We're focused on the future. We've been very impressed with CMP as their owner. They've improved their earnings each year over the last 10 years. They're on their way to doubling their profitability. He spent his whole time talking about how CMP is making money for Iberdrola. This made news in Maine. It was shared wildly on social media and all sorts of groups. This is a company that has really built a reputation in the state of Maine as caring only about money, largely because of its parent company, Iberdrola and Avangrid, and their focus on squeezing out profit. So I also mentioned how CMP was really at the forefront of trying to prevent clean energy legislation coming into the state of Maine. So you can imagine the response from Mainers, folks like me in the environmental and renewable energy community, when we see CMP suddenly saying, oh, we're all for green energy. We've got to, you know, help fight climate change, support this transmission line. They weren't exactly the best, you know, group making that argument when they're making it to a bunch of people that they've spent the last couple of years trying to defeat clean energy legislation. So it really fell on deaf ears because of that. And people just frankly don't trust them.
And it's not just NECEC opposition who cited CMP's poor reputation as a detriment to this project. Here's Ben Dudley.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Adam. And, you know, it's not just me, a really sort of highly respected columnist in the Portland Press Herald, Bill Nemitz, wrote a piece shortly after the election where he basically said the same thing, is that this election was really about punishing CMP. It wasn't really about this transmission line. It was an opportunity for the public to deliver a message to CMP with whom they're frustrated. And it's also reflected in the campaign rhetoric that came out of No CMP Corridor, who in event after event would say, you can't trust CMP. You can't trust CMP. It was just repeated over and over again. It's why they labeled it the CMP Corridor. I mean, they knew that they had a bad guy that they could, you know, in quotes, that they could align with this project and try and sink the project by tying it to CMP. And it was frustrating because what got lost is an actual conversation about the facts.
Now, you might have heard in Adam's clip that CMP was also associated with efforts to kill a solar net metering bill in 2017 through their relationship and contributions to Governor Paula Page's Political Action Committee, a governor who stood against solar net metering, as well as a CMP lobbyist, Joel Harrington, who spoke out against net metering as well. Now, net metering is a critical component of making rooftop solar more accessible by requiring utility companies to buy back excess energy from household solar into the grid at retail rates instead of wholesale. It has been a thorn in the side of many utility companies around the country. Ironically enough, NextEra, the largest financial supporter of the opposition to the NECEC and CMP, is the parent company of Florida Light and Power, Florida's largest utility, which has been trying to put a stop to net metering in the Sunshine State. But I would guess that many of the Mainers who stood against CMP on the grounds of their pushback or their efforts to stall solar net metering may not realize that one of the companies funding their efforts to do so is doing the same thing in another state. That's how convoluted this can get. Sandra Howard also agrees that CMP's involvement was the beginning of the end of this project for many local Mainers.
Well, absolutely. If we were going to contract a business to do repairs on our home, we'd likely want to go with a contractor that has a reputation for adequate service, right? And so I would consider this idea of the CMP corridor and the ratepayer problems, if you will, as being a perfect storm, especially when we talk about the way that voting happened at the state referendum this last November. So CMP has essentially done it to themselves, where they, they haven't solved all the overbilling still, the metering problems, the customer service. They haven't maintained maintenance on their archaic infrastructure. So Maine is also known as the blackout capital of the country. So we have longer power outages, more frequent power outages. About 80% of residents in Jackman, Maine, this is up toward the Quebec border in Western Maine, about 80% of Jackman residents own a generator. And so we're talking about, customers that know they need to have a backup. So this is a company that has not done well by its customers. And so if they're saying they want to develop a project that ultimately will benefit them and their profits without having made it right by their current ratepayers, the current ratepayers aren't interested in more responsibility that CMP would have. So when we were at the DEP, Thorne Dickinson talked about if there was a power outage and this NECEC line had been developed, they would have to restore power for the DC line, the CMP corridor, before restoring power to the current AC infrastructure because of their contracts with Massachusetts. So that would further extend power restoration times. So we're giving more responsibility to a company that can't handle its own load now. I think there's a lot of trepidation about that. And so, people simply don't trust CMP. And when they found out this project had been talked about with, the 30 or 40 or so towns on the line without going through a transparent public process, people felt very betrayed and that they were not involved in a project that was going to be fast-tracked. So I think you're right. I think if it hadn't been CMP proposing it where they did on, the route that they proposed, I think it would have had more likability.
Now, I asked Thorne, again, the architect of this project and CEO of the NECEC, to comment on the role of CMP's reputation and how it factored in to what happened.
And you definitely would need some kind of a time machine. And I think you'd probably need to go back, not just before the billing issue, but I think also prior to that, and CMP's position on solar. This was probably 8-10 years ago. Again, I was in a different place working on different things, and I was aware of it living here in Maine. But a group of people that were trying to get more and more solar development, and CMP pushed back against those things on cost and what it would mean. And I think it destroyed or damaged a lot of relationships with the environmental NGOs, and that includes, Natural Resources Council of Maine, the Conservation Law Center, the Nature Conservancy, the Acadia Center, the key people that show up in Maine and participate in these processes. So when we were becoming public, my instinct was that we were going to need to have environmental groups that understand the benefits of the project. To me, it was so clear how good this project was. And I had conversations with all the major environmental groups, and they all had a very similar message, that they were very frustrated with CMP and the role that they played here, and they're looking for a new CMP. In the case of Conservation Law Foundation in Acadia, that led to a two-year conversation about them asking questions about the project and me trying to work back with the organization to make changes at CMP that they wanted to see. In the end, we had an agreement that recognized with them the benefits, but also had some real significant requirements associated with CMP and Avangrid. Could never get the Natural Resources Council of Maine there. The first conversation we had, and we had a guy named Doug Foy, really one of the founders of the environmental movement here in Northeast, it didn't go well. I'll just say that way. If you talk with any interesting how they describe it, I continue to try to find a way to have good pragmatic conversations, but really failed. That having one environmental NGO come out so strongly against the project really gave the opportunity for somebody like NextEra to come in and plant their operations here within the state. That would be the one thing. If I don't know how far back I'd have to go back in order to avoid those impacts that happened that resulted in NRCM taking the position that they did. I think that was the biggest thing as project related happened. And then obviously the continued challenges that CMP had over the last few years just gave an incredible source of opportunity. Clearly, I believe that the campaign that was built around this that included the opposition people used those things and highlighted them in a way that wouldn't have normally happened had not the light of the project been.
It's worth noting that there are major efforts right now in Maine to shift utilities from investor-owned outputs like CMP to customer-owned ones. A group known as Our Power is spearheading these efforts, and it will likely come to a similar public referendum vote as the NECEC did last fall. The thinking here is consumer-owned utilities set up as nonprofits will better support smaller local generation where possible and put consumer priorities over financial ones. In fact, of the six cities in the U.S. that are currently operating on 100% renewable energy, all of them have public-owned utilities. It doesn't always work out that way, however. For example, the majority of utilities in Nebraska are publicly consumer-owned, and they buy a lot of coal-powered electricity because it's cheaper than alternatives. While they're not motivated by profits per se, they're motivated to keep costs down for local residents. So shifting to a consumer-owned structure can be a net positive for shifting to renewables. It can go the other way as well. We'll have to see how it plays out here in Maine, but there's a lot of momentum behind it. Nonetheless, when it comes to our larger topic here of how these large-scale renewable energy projects get local public support going forward, the lesson here in Maine is the relationship between the utility companies involved and their customers can play an enormous factor. Even if a project is generally supported across the board, distrust in a local utility can kill it. Another reason that those behind these projects can no longer simply rely on the traditional regulatory approval processes going forward.
You know, CMP's reputation is what it is. And I want to say the people that I worked with there are really good people who were in this for all the right reasons. But I also understand why people in Maine were frustrated with CMP. So disclose my biases. But one thing I would have done differently is recognize earlier that this was a public battle, not just a regulatory battle. The other side, through a dark money entity, the money behind which we still don't know, was on television in 2018, 2019, December and January. This was, you know, more than 3 years ago, falsely claiming that this project would cut a swath through the Maine woods wider than the New Jersey Turnpike. Setting aside the fact that it's just a lie, what they were clever in doing was taking the fight to the public very early. And this was 3 years before it appeared on any ballot. And I think CMP could have recognized sooner that they needed to be fighting a public campaign, not just one in front of the courts and in front of regulatory agencies.
As we learned from Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. For Adam Cote and many Mainers who stood against this project, CMP has enormous power, but has not lived up to expectations around responsibility. And that made this project so hard to get behind.
Because when you think of the importance of what a utility is, right? A utility at its essence, it's a company that's given a monopoly over a certain important public service or, you know, whether it's telecommunications, water, sewer, you know, electricity. They're given a lot of power over a certain industry and they need to deliver on that. And here's an example of one that didn't do its basic functions correctly. And as a result, when they're trying to, you know, get support from folks on a project that's going to make them a bunch of money, people are like, no, I'm not going to support you on that. You wouldn't even get my bill correctly. How can I trust you to do this?
In the end, despite getting proper regulatory approval every step of the way, the NECEC and Hydro-Québec saw their project get stalled via a groundswell of public opposition that resulted in that referendum last November. In the mind of many Mainers, they did not feel that local communities along the corridor line were engaged early enough in this process. They questioned or were not fully aware of the different benefits outlined for them. And the mere involvement of a utility company they do not trust were all factors in their 60-40 decision to stand against it. Even for opposition folks like the NRCM, they do not want to see a larger swing of distrust in our government and scientific institutions, just because they don't trust the outcome of this particular initiative.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yes, I think public distrust of government and our scientific institutions is a problem. And a lot of times it's not justified. Sometimes it is justified. And, you know, that's, I mean, part of what we do in an environmental advocacy world is to try to shine some light on decisions that, in our case, state government makes that may not be in the best interest of the environment. You know, we certainly strongly disagreed with both the DEP and the Maine PUC and felt that, you know, their decisions on the CMP corridor were not based in good science. And that's unfortunate because we do need people to trust their government, and we do need the government to work in ways that make sense to help fight climate change. And this is a good example of that not happening. And yes, it's very frustrating.
Now, whether we like it or not, across the board, we are seeing continued deterioration in the trust in our institutions and experts. And this is in part due to the extreme polarizing rhetoric that powers media business models on both the left and the right. Bringing this all back to our opener and how Facebook's newsfeed in 2009 laid the groundwork for some of the dynamic that played out here in Maine. Now, this is an important case study for many other infrastructure and clean energy projects going forward.
It pains me to say this, but you know, I think any sort of significant investment in this kind of infrastructure, anybody who's contemplating it needs to go into it assuming that there's going to be a huge public battle fought on the airwaves and in social media and in grassroots organizing. And you know, the result of that is the public will more and more devalue the expertise that exists within the institutions that exist, that were designed to represent and to enforce the public interest. Entities like the Public Utilities Commission, the Department of Environmental Protection. You know, we're going to diminish our reliance on the experts, the impartial experts who were tasked with collecting the information and arriving at the truth, collecting the facts and arriving at the truth. And instead, it's going to be fought at the ballot box where, you know, I think we all recognize, you know, the truth and the facts often get lost or get undervalued.
Now, if you recall at the top of the episode, we highlighted a recent study that shows how dozens of clean energy projects are getting blocked or stalled across the country from public pushback, some with legitimate merit for doing so, others with more questionable foundations. The challenges of our current regulatory systems also go beyond their need to involve local communities in a more direct way. The study showed that there are often many conflicts between state and federal laws when it comes to environmental assessments, permitting, and the inclusion of tribal consultation. When you have projects that cross states, things can get even messier still. Our system in place for reviewing these policies was primarily built to support highly centralized, large-scale fossil fuel projects many years ago. The world of renewables is far more complex, and there are far more projects, creating unique challenges in determining which ones should move forward or not. A quote from that study from Joe Ran from the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab reads, "The interconnection queue process, as it exists today, was not designed for this volume of new projects we're seeing. It was designed around centralized, large-scale fossil fuel projects. Now we have thousands of projects."
Yeah, the public hasn't come to grips with the degree of change that we're going to have to see in the next decade or two to if we're serious about addressing this problem. I mean, we're going to have to build a lot of infrastructure, which on the other hand is also a very exciting opportunity on the economic front.
As a result, renewable electricity generation is growing while the transmission infrastructure needed to move it is slowing. The best path forward for fixing this likely lies in including local community members and all relevant stakeholders in every stage of review of these projects going forward. Yes, that is more cumbersome and it adds time and cost to these reviews, but it's better to deal with the perception of possible risks and potential benefits early on before folks made up their minds and then trying to course correct retroactively. Putting the actual merits of the NECEC aside, which again, will be determined in courts in Maine, it certainly seems that there was opportunity here to involve local communities in deeper ways earlier on in the process. Thank you for tuning in here to episode 3. In our next episode, we're going to tackle the third and final major theme of the story, which is how large energy companies are using a consistent playbook to block or stall clean energy projects around the country that are not their own, that they don't directly profit from. We'll explore how that factored in here to what happened in Maine. What happened in Maine and what it means for these projects more broadly going forward. Thank you as always for supporting Animalia and the stories we cover. Most of all, thank you for doing your part and caring about this big, beautiful planet and all the incredible life that calls it home. So long.